Hello and welcome to In Focus with Insight. My name is Pamela Hillig. I'm Head of Insight Life Solutions, and this is an episode of the Open Books series in which we get to know interesting and inspiring people in the actuarial and insurance community through the books that they have read and loved. Today I'm joined by Margie Conradi. Margie is a healthcare actuary and high school mathematics teacher with a passion for education and accessibility. Her career has spanned consultancy, product design, teaching at an all-boys boarding school, and now lecturing at tertiary level. She hosts a podcast called So What's It Actuary About? That unpacks the field of actuarial science, and she runs a YouTube channel focused on solving mathematics past papers for matric students. She's recently embarked on a master's in education and is always looking for new challenges and opportunities to make learning more engaging, inclusive, and impactful. Welcome to the podcast, Margie.
Thank you very much.
Now, I know that you're a podcaster, but are you also a reader?
I am an avid reader.
So happy to hear that, because this is not like other interviews or podcasts you may have been involved in, and that we will get to know you and talk about your career journey and things you're busy with, but with the added angle of the books that have shaped you in some way. So you can think of it as the Desert Island Discs for bibliophile. But before we get into the books, tell me, what is keeping you busy these days?
So I am currently working at FITS as a lecturer. And that keeps me busy most days. But then in between that, I am doing my master's, as you said, in education. So I'm attending lectures and reading a lot of research papers on various educational theory, which I'm enjoying. But then I am also married and we have just bought a house. And I had no idea that houses was just the gift that keeps on giving from a to-do list perspective. It just never ends. No, so I'm just like, honestly, can you just work? And then we have just adopted a little dog called Diego.
Okay.
And he's a little border collie. And he is trying to chew everything in the house. So
looking after him.
A friend of mine. And I'm hoping that she's keeping him away from everything that he wants to bite. But we'll see when we get home.
Okay, and you still have some time for reading in between.
Always.
Make time for it. So before we get into the books, just to warm up, I'd like to ask some questions about your reading habits. So how would you, in general, describe your relationship with reading and with books?
So I think to me, it's been an interesting journey because, as we sort of chatted about prior to this, I struggled to read as a child. And so I think words were something that actually I was a little bit fearful of because I didn't always find them easy to access. And so being the daughter of an English teacher, my mom was like, okay, how are we going to solve this problem? And so my first access to books was actually through audiobooks. And so I started on, you know, back in the day, little tapes, and like every now and then the tape recorder would chew them. And then, you know, when you had to take your pencil and you're like, please tell me what's happening in the story. I know. And then like putting sticky tape to be like, tell me the story. And then transition to CDs and now onto audiobooks. And so much of my reading has actually been soft reading in the more that it's been listening. And so I think for me, the draw to books has always been the stories and the characters. And I think what I love about reading is that you can access whole worlds that you didn't know existed or don't exist, but have been created for you to enjoy. And I think that that's been a privilege. And then also my sister is actually doing her PhD in English.
Oh,
and wow. So the two of us are very close. And so her sort of interest and spark for literature and reading, I think, feeds into me. So she's probably my chief channel of recommendations. And yeah, so I think that's kind of been my reading journey. As my reading improved and I became more confident in that space, I would read more sort of tangible hardbacks, softbacks. But audiobooks have always held a special place in my heart, I think, just because that was my initial access. And so I find it very easy to listen, because that's how I experience books as my initial.
Which book have you reread the most?
Sure.
Which one do you tend to go back to?
Lord of the Rings, I must say, is probably my number one, to be honest. It's actually the strangest thing, because I think as much as there's not many female characters in Lord of the Rings, I resonate with the story so much. And I think because I view life as this journey. I feel like I'm, especially with Sam. Sam is my favorite character. Like, I,
for a second, I thought you meant solvency assessment.
Oh, no, not that. Not that. Sam Wise, Gamgee. And I think there's just such a comfort in that space for me, and especially because it's a different world. Mm. I think, you know, when this world gets a bit much for me, which happens more frequently than I would like, sometimes escaping to another world is comforting.
So you say fantasy is your favorite genre, or what genres do you enjoy?
It's difficult to say, because I think I find people intrinsically interesting. And so if a character is well built, regardless of what setting they're in, I enjoy the book generally. Right. And so I think what I like about fantasy is I find it more of a challenge to imagine the person, if that makes sense, because you're like, I don't understand the context. But as long as the character is robust and has kind of like substance to them, I find it quite easy to access.
Do you have a favorite character in literature?
Ooh, I think one of my favorite characters, one that's jumping to mind now, is Anne from Anne of Green Gables. I think I love her optimism. I love that she's a teacher, which is a big thing for me. I love her kind of view of the world and how she sees things completely differently to other people and brings this new perspective to the people around her. I think there's a lot of aspects of her that I would love to be or embody.
Spoiler alert.
Yes, yeah. It's a must read.
One of the books we're going to talk about. So yeah, on that note, let's get into them. What's the first book we're going to
I'm going to do it in order. Very, very A-type over here. So my first book, and let me show you, is Middlemarch. So I didn't bring the books because I traveled from Joburg and it didn't seem like a good call to bring them all in my hand luggage. So it's Middlemarch by George Eliot. And for those of you who don't know, George Eliot was actually a woman, Mary Ann Evans. And it was during a time where women were not really respected or acknowledged as authors. Mm-hmm. And so she actually published under George Eliot. And so that book for me is an interesting one. It's considered a classic in the sense that it's older.
1800s.
Yeah, 1800s. Yeah. I think its first release was like 1809, somewhere around there. And what I love about it is the main character, Dorothea, she's one of those people that wants to make an impact in the world. Like, she wants to do good. But the story is about her continuously trying to do good, but always coming short of her own expectations of what that is or what that could be. And I think she encounters various things and has to grow through sort of a losing a husband, falling in love again, etc. There's many sort of narratives there, but she constantly wants to do good. And I think I found that very inspiring. I think not only because of her, but because it's a story written a while ago.
Yeah.
And there's that element where it's like, okay, there is that element of where people want to do good. And I find that encouraging, especially in a world where I think people do a lot of bad, to have people that genuinely want to help people around them to whatever degree that is.
I guess it speaks to the timelessness or the universality of human nature.
Yeah.
Maybe feminism to an extent as well.
Yeah.
When did this book come into your life? You know, inspired to read it?
It's interestingly enough, it's a bit of a weird story. So it actually came into my life through CNA, right?
Is CNA still around?
I don't know. I think there's like the odd one. I think it's now been taken over by PNA. But anyways, CNA had this.
You can still smell the shop.
No, I know. And all the highlighters in like 10 to 15 different colors. Just is amazing. They had this series called Classics, right? And basically what they did is there were DVD sets, and it was all the classics that had been made into sort of short series. So it wasn't sort of, you know, like a very concise view like of various classics. So they had Jane Austen's, they had the Brontes, etc. And Middlemarch was one of them. And I remember watching it actually first. And it came with sort of a little booklet with it, a little magazine, which gave you background.
And then you put it in a big file.
No, exactly. Exactly. And you collected all of them, and the backs of the DVDs made a picture. You know, one of those, like, it was super old school, but I loved it. And I think when I encountered it, it was partially because my mother is an English teacher, and so I think she wanted us to engage with classics. Mm. But I think when I had watched it, I was like, no, this is, I resonate with this character. And I love that. I mean, there's in the movie, it's not so much in the book, but in the movie, they capture certain aspects of Dorothea, which are encapsulated in the book,
okay.
which I loved. And yeah, Dorothea was just something that sort of I was drawn to. And then I was like, I must read the book. Well, listen to the book.
Would you say that that's one of the better kind of book to film adaptations, or what books do you think have been made into amazing movies?
I think it's a good question. I think often the books that are made into good film edits are more the short series, where they actually try to capture the full narrative of the book without trying to take out portions, mm-hmm. where you have sort of a, you know, 6 to 10 episodes. Those are generally the best, in my opinion, because they actually represent the book. Whereas I think what's difficult about other representations, for example, Harry Potter, is that from the 4th to the 8th movie, they changed the story. You know, and I think what's difficult about that is when you have diehard fans of the book, then when you watch the movie, you're actually very disappointed because you're like, this is not the story I know and love. And so I think it's very difficult to capture a book well in a movie when you have limited time. I think one that's been done particularly well is The Lord of the Rings, but I'm a little bit biased.
Back to Middlemarch, do you have a favorite quote from
the book? I do, and I'm going to read it because I didn't learn it off by heart. I'm not that A type. The growing
you
bit of
some interpretive dance.
No, some ribbon. The growing good of the world is partly dependent on unhistoric acts, and that things are not so ill with you and me as they might have been is half owing to the number who lived faithfully a hidden life and rest in unvisited tombs.
The unsung heroes.
Yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah.
And I think what I liked about that is that I think especially as a child and as a budding woman, I think there's often this desire to be something significant.
Mm.
You know, I want to make my life matter. And I think so often we think that that means being known and being celebrated widely. And I think what I liked about Dorothea is it wasn't about being known. It was about doing good, regardless of whether that was recognized or not, because it does make a difference in the grander scheme of things, even if it isn't recognized at the time.
So I suspect that your kind of doing good is channeled through, you know, your passion for education and accessibility. So what does that mean in the context of your work, and why is this accessibility so important to you?
So it's a very interesting question in the sense that I think part of the reason I was drawn to education is because I struggled to read and because I struggled to access words. And my mother played an very, very intrinsic role in getting me to a point where I could access words and I could read. She actually took me out of school when I was in grade 4 because I still couldn't read properly by then. And over that year and half of grade 5 or all of grade 5, we basically went back to basics and we sort of, you know, did our phonics, etc. And by the time I went back to school in grade 6, I was fluent and flew. And I think I saw the difference that my mom made in my life by being intentional and being a teacher. And that kind of then fed into my own passion of saying the difference. Obviously, we can't make the same difference that a mother would in every person's life. But being a good teacher is a very, very influential and impactful role. And I think that has, I think, in many ways defined a lot of my life, because I know what it's like to be in a space where you feel like you can't access something, even though you have potential. And so if someone recognize that potential and say, let's partner together and get you to a point where you are closer or able to realize your potential. And so I guess you could classify that as doing good, but for me it's also an element of paying it forward, because I wouldn't be anywhere close to where I am now if it wasn't for that intervention at an early stage.
How are you bringing that accessibility into actuarial studies, which is notoriously exclusionary and inaccessible?
I know. I think my podcast is probably an aspect of that. I think when I started my podcast, it was to encourage students and to sort of say to them, like, there's a broader society or industry of actuaries that have gone before you. And it was to voice those conversations and have them recorded. I think with actuarial science, I think I always saw it as almost a step before then. So as you mentioned earlier, I have a YouTube channel doing maths past papers, and my heart behind that was that I started it during COVID, actually, was not everyone has access to a good teacher, or not everyone has access to a teacher, full stop. And by doing past papers on YouTube, where it's freely available, people can access that and use it as they want. And I think in my mind, if you're not good at maths at school, you're not even going to get like through the door with actuarial science. So I guess it was a feeder to an extent. But in the actual classroom, I think it's difficult to bring that into focus other than the way you speak and the way you relate to people, where you make them feel welcomed. And you try not to use language that, you know, certain people wouldn't understand, especially if they're not first language English speakers, that sort of thing. So that would kind of be my focus there. But it's a difficult thing with actuarial science because there's that barrier to entry from the get-go. But I think something I always say to my students is don't make being an actuary your whole life or becoming an actuary your whole life, because it won't fulfill you, right? Your profession is not going to fulfill you across the board in your life. Like, it will bring fulfillment to a degree, but there's more to life than that. And I think that that's part of those conversations. But I think it's an ongoing problem. I don't think I'll solve it. But I would like to contribute to it maybe being a bit of a smoother process for people.
Picking up where William Smith left off.
I mean, I don't know about that, but thank you.
Do you say to your students, look to your left, look to your right?
No, I do not do that, because I remember when I was sitting in first year and they did that, I was like, I'm sure I'm one of those people that's going to be leaving. I'm not going to be that one in three that stays.
Yeah, and I think our lecturer said, actually, it's even less than that, though.
No, I know.
No, actually,
demoralizing, actually.
Yeah, just because it's true doesn't mean you have to.
No, exactly. There's numerous statistics that we don't need to bring to the fore.
Okay, what's the next book we're going to talk
about? So next book, and I think I've really talked about this extensively, so I might need to jump over it, but it's The Fellowship of the Ring by J.R.R. Tolkien.
I can see you brought the original edition. 1950 or whenever it was.
I'm a massive fan of Lord of the Rings. I think, as I said before, I think I enjoy that camaraderie in it, but I think what is special about Lord of the Rings for me is the friendships that are built there. Like, there's very little throughout the three book, or it's actually six books, but three actual bound books that is about romance or anything like that. It's about this sort of cohesion, working as a team to get something done. And so I would say it's actually probably more about like work than it is anything else, because they had this goal to destroy the ring and they had to work together and split up and come back together in order to reach that goal. And so I think I've always enjoyed that because I like a challenge and I like following a journey. And then I also just resonate completely with Samwise. If I could be like Samwise, I think I'd be happy to die.
Who wouldn't want a friend like Samwise?
No, I know. Someone who's going to carry you up Mount Doom. I mean, how many friends do you have putting up the hand for that? Sorry? Exactly. He cooked food. He did the brace of conies, the two rabbits that Gollum gets for Frodo. He cooks up for him. And yeah, so I think I enjoy that. I think I also just enjoy like the arc with Aragorn, for example, where he goes from being a ranger to the king of Gondor. And there's that element of sort of growth into roles that you didn't think that you would get to. And so I think there's a lot that I think I've learned probably more from just a general progression perspective that I found quite inspiring about Lord of the Rings.
So true what you say about them. Not actually, it's not a group of friends. It's a group of colleagues.
Yeah, they have a job, right? like they wouldn't have been mates unless they had this core aim. Like Legolas and Gimli actually hate each other from the beginning. And I mean, we all have colleagues we don't like. And then at the end, they become the best of mates, you know, and it's work.
Gosh, I need to bring this into, you know, my management style somehow.
You can be Gandalf. bringing like that, a general kind of, I bring the team together. This is what we're going to do.
I wish my hair would grow that long.
But not that great.
The gray we can cover.
Put on one of those hats.
Do you have a favorite quote?
I do. So it's actually by Aragorn. And he says, courage is found in unlikely places. And I think for me, I mean, there's innumerable quotes I love from Lord of the Rings. Yeah. But I like that one in particular because I think courage in many ways defines your life. Because I think the decisions that we make and the moments where we have courage are often times when we do things that we didn't know we were capable of doing. And I think those are the things that push us beyond our comfort zones and often develop us into the people we ultimately become. And so what I like about the unlikely places is that sometimes we don't know when we need courage. Like sometimes, like coming on the podcast, like there's courage that you need for that. And sometimes there's courage for presenting a lecture, you know. I get nervous before every single lecture, and I've lectured for 2 years now, kind of thing. But courage is what I think pushes us forward. So without courage, I don't know if the world would really progress.
That's so true. The world or ourselves. Like,
yeah.
And I think often comes out of necessity.
It's like, I'm in front of a dragon. I have to fight the dragon or I'm going
to
die.
Exactly. I didn't choose to put myself here.
Yeah.
You know, it's for a greater cause, or it's because you don't have a choice and you have to be brave.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think a lot of my life has been defined by moments of courage. And I think what Aragorn sort of hones in on there resonated with me, even though I encountered this as before I had to take many courageous steps. But it's I think has sort of stuck with me as I've journeyed on.
Can you think of an example of a moment of courage?
So I think a big one for me was when I decided to leave corporate and to go teach in a school. People thought I was crazy.
Yeah, because you taught high school.
I qualified as an actuary, and then that year I did my PGCE, which is basically my teacher's certificate. And then the following year, I had worked part time during that time when I was doing my PGCE, and then got to the end of the year, and I was kind of at a crossroads where it was either that I go and I steep myself in corporate, or I give this a proper go. And I go teach, like I just jump in head first. And I think everyone thought, when I say everyone, I mean literally everyone, like my colleagues, even some family members, even like some friends, people thought I was crazy because they were like, you've worked for, then it was 7 years to become an actuary and now you're going to become a teacher. Like surely you could have just done like an education degree. And I think that was a moment of courage for me because I remember looking at myself in the mirror, and I'll speak to some of this with some of the other books that I'll mention, but I remember looking at myself and saying, you know, at the end of the day, I have to live with myself. Yeah. And I want to teach, and so I'm going to do this because it's something I want to do, and I'm still an actuary. It's not like you can take that away from me. Like, I'm still an actuary. Just because I've become a teacher doesn't mean that I'm not an actuary. And I think I was a profoundly better teacher for being an actuary, and I'm a profoundly better actuary for being a teacher. And so I think that was a moment of courage because I moved away from home. So I moved to another province. I took a paycheck that was 30% of what I was being paid as an actuary. And I started at the bottom. You know, I was a junior teacher. I was given junior classes. There was not much prestige at all. I had very snooty parents and their emails and whatever. And that was fine because that's what I wanted. And so I think that stands out to me as a moment of courage.
And I think as actuaries, we are taught to be so risk averse.
Yes.
Yeah. So anything we do is especially courageous because it goes against all our training and all our.
Yeah, it's like what's bred into us. And I think also something that also attracts a lot of people to actuarial science is being in a career that you earn well.
Yeah.
And true. So I think going from being a qualified actuary, because I was qualified, to then getting a teacher salary, people were like, why? I mean, I remember one of my ex-colleagues saying to me, like, I would have loved to be a teacher, but I can't afford to. kind of thing. And obviously, there were various things in my life that accommodated that decision. But I think it also brought into sort of focus that a lot of people do actuarial science for money.
Hmm.
And that is obviously a personal decision, but that wasn't mine.
Well, as you say, the teacher, I guess being a teacher makes you a bit of an actuary and that way around. So it's such a gift to be able to do that for students.
Yeah, it's a gift, but I think it's also a massive area of development for me. I think something that I enjoy about lecturing is I think if you are a intentional lecturer and it's something you care about, you are always improving the way that you communicate. And so some lectures I'm like, yeah, no, that was, will not go down in history, put it that way. Maybe it's the worst lecture ever, but not as the best lecture ever. And I think that's something which I think is a life lesson from actuarial science and from lecturing, is that sometimes your best day will be followed by your worst day. And like, I can have one day where I have given the lecture of my life, like honestly. And then the next day I'm like fumbling around being like, sorry guys, I'll post something on like your student website later just to clarify. I'm like, so I think there's been a number of lessons that I've learned from that. But I think that ability and the opportunity to be able to explain complex things to students is something I value very highly.
I think what you say now about, your best day following your worst day applies to so many. It can apply to work. It can apply
to personal relationships.
To working out. One day you have it all and you have the
next day you pull all your muscles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess we're all just trying to improve it through each day.
Exactly. Exactly.
What's the third book we're going to talk about?
Okay. So the third book is, and I've mentioned it just now, is Anne of Green Gables. So Anne of Green Gables is by Alem Montgomery. And I encountered this actually with my sister. My sister's 2 years younger than me. So I think a lot of our childhood, especially because my reading lagged a bit, we encountered areas of literature together. So it felt like this was like a joint adventure we went on. And, we both absolutely loved Anne of Green Gables. She is, so not to spoil anything, but she was an orphan and she's adopted by a sister and brother. And she just has this like magical view of the world. And the story is also underpinned by a love story where she, there's a guy in her class that falls for her for like day one. And she is not interested because he called her carrots because she has red hair. And she is like, I can't stand you. And then anyway, she ends up with him. And I think as a young sort of idealistic little girl, I was like, that's the kind of love I want, someone who like wants you from the beginning and you're not interested and they like pursue you, like all these sort of things. Oh, but like, all these kind of things. And the thing is, she, in the midst of it also, I think what I loved about the love story is that he loved her for who she was. And it was more about her mind and her personality that he loved about her. And I think that is, I think, what all of us want at our core is to be loved for who we are, not what we look like or what we bring, for who we are. And I think that was always something that I aspired to say, if I am to have a partner in life, I want them to love that about me, because that's something I can deliver on perpetually. Like I can promise you to be me. So I think that element of it was beautiful. But she was also a lover of words. She was a teacher and a writer. So I think there were many aspects of her that I just found humorous and inspiring. Just pulled me into her narrative.
What's especially nice about the love story is that she wasn't a demure, typical...
Oh, no. She was like a bull in a china shop.
Yeah, which most people, men, society would try to change.
Subdue her.
Exactly.
No. And Gilbert was like, no, go girl. Like, be my girl, but go girl.
Did you watch was it in the 80s?
Loved it. Loved it with the... can't remember the actresses' names, but I did love... And I thought they characterized, like, who they cast for the different roles was perfect, according to the book.
I often, I think, of a certain age, you know, we can probably be characterized by like three videotapes of our childhood that we just like watched.
No, I know exactly. And you can like sing the song and
Exactly.
you know, all the
Shakespeare for you.
characters. No, I know.
But
So
yeah, but I remember, yeah, my sister was a big fan of this, so that was one of the things that we had to watch all the time.
yeah, my sister and I loved it. Also, just like she does the strangest things, like she chases cows and falls in mud, and she bakes a cake and messes it up, and she makes her friend drunk because she thinks that the juice that she's given her is non-alcoholic, and then her friend's mother bans her from seeing the friend. It's just like these crazy stories. She dyes her hair green because she has like a this it'll just sort of like hang up on having red hair, and she thinks she's ugly. So it's very relatable. I think all girls go through similar stages. Maybe don't act the same way. I've never dyed my hair green, but there's that element of where you resonate with her maturity as she kind of journeys through her life and makes decisions, and I enjoy that.
Yeah, this, you know, it's like a so, you know, it's a long
Yeah, it is. I mean,
term
you
journey.
literally go from her being, I think, just before they don't actually say her age necessarily. I think she's just before teenagehood. And you go through her sort of high school and then her university experience and there
I
afterwards.
think they had the same, and they had the same actress.
Yes, I know they did.
But
Yeah.
she becomes a teacher, right?
She becomes a
Yeah.
teacher and then she becomes a novelist.
Okay.
Yeah,
Okay.
yeah. And I think I enjoyed also how she taught and the obstacles she encountered in the classroom. And how she dealt with them. I just enjoyed
Draws for
that.
inspiration.
No, exactly. And be like, okay, I wasn't the only one.
Do you have a favorite quote
I
from?
do, I do. So it is, isn't it nice to think that tomorrow is a new day with no mistakes in it? So
So
I
far,
resonate with that in the
one
sense
of
that,
those days.
yeah, exactly. But I think also, I mean, it makes you think that every day does have mistakes. So it's not that tomorrow won't have mistakes. It's just you can create those mistakes for yourself and you can learn from today's mistakes, and so the mistakes of tomorrow will be different.
Yeah. And you can like reset, you know.
No, exactly. You know, it's like a loop. You get to try again tomorrow. And if tomorrow doesn't go well, you try again the next day, kind of thing. And so I think I like the freshness of that. Also, what I like about it is that element of where you can sleep something off. You know, something that's devastating today is sometimes less devastating tomorrow, which I find soothing, because sometimes in the moment I'm like, I'm never going to recover from this. And then the next day you're like, actually, it's fine. My lecture was bad, but today's lecture will be better.
You're so right. Yeah, I think we can all resonate with that. What's it like being an actuarial student in 2025?
I think it depends on what year you're in. I think if you're in first year, probably quite traumatic because it's the first time I think
So that hasn't changed.
no, and I think that that will never change because I think what happens is you have sort of a very concentrated pool of intelligent students, and those students have never been in a space where they've interacted with so many people in their same intellectual sort of level or echelon. And I think that can be difficult because you start feeling normal within a space where actually everyone is actually fairly exceptional. I think also first year is difficult because it's the first time that some of those students actually start figuring out what it is that actuarial science is. Because many
Well, they'll be
students are,
lucky if they figure it out on first
no, I
year.
mean, well, they start figuring out whether they like it or not. And then I think towards the later years, I mean, I don't think you have much of a varsity life as an actuarial student, but just because of the rigor of the course. But I think there is an element of where worry starts kicking in towards the end, where you've sort of got through this very demanding course and then you're now wanting to get a job and kind of thinking to yourself, well, what sort of job do I want? What sort of jobs are available? Am I going to get a job? And I think in a world also of AI, there are these constant sort of pressures where students are saying, you know, is there a place for me? And so I think I mean, obviously there's a breadth of experience because you have different personalities, but I think the common thing is that students realize that what's being demanded of them is very, very draining, and many of them don't make it through. But there is still that, I attended a graduation the other day, and there's still that immense feeling of pride I can see in the students when they actually finish. And so I think there's elements of that journey that have stayed consistent over time. I just think the stresses, I would say, are the same, except for the employment stresses. I think that has become a growing front for a number of students.
Yeah, because in addition to the, I guess, the financial attractions of actuarial science that people have always been drawn to, there's also always been that job security.
Employability.
Yeah. That assumption of employability. But has the conversation around mental health things in terms of stress?
I think there definitely has been more awareness, and I think some of that awareness is attributable to actually Soshin. I think he's kind of spearheaded some of those conversations along with Shivani. And I think there is more talk about it. There's also definitely more resources now. So I've worked at two different universities, and both of those universities, there's now psychological assistance, which is freely available. And I think that is important, because you're talking about high achieving people, and high achieving people don't do well with failure because they have not encountered it often. And so when they encounter failure, and I can talk from my personal experience, when I failed my first actuarial science test, I thought my world was going to implode. And it was like a 50 mark test. I had no perspective whatsoever. But I think that element of being in a very competitive environment, knowing that you're doing something very prestigious, and pressures that come from family, etc., can be very difficult in that space. And so I think my encouragement there would be to students to actually use those facilities, because I think it's one thing having the support, but I think there is still stigma to a degree about certain issues within mental illness or mental struggles, not even illness. You know, you can have sort of moments in time where your mental health is not great without having necessarily a long-term issue with it. But yeah. I think students, especially high achieving students, I think are sometimes slow to admit to having issues in that space because they want to be seen as more resilient or untouchable or whatever it is that they're aiming to be. But I don't think that's necessarily a wise way of going about it. Get help. If you need help, get help.
Some things never change. But hopefully it is, destigmatized to an extent compared to, days you were at Vastio or I was. I think it's always been stressful, and it seems that students out there are kind of suffering from the same issues.
Yeah, and I think part of that is also because maturity does happen over time. And I think that certain experiences are common to all people. And I think that time at university is quite a core time of development. And so I think the struggles are fairly universal, but when you're going through it, it doesn't feel universal. It feels very personal and very traumatic, and you're like, oh, this is uncalled for. I think that's encouragement I would have to students, is that this too shall pass.
Didn't Gandalf say
he said you shall not pass?
But I was listening to it a bit. What's the next book we're going to talk about?
So the next one is another fantasy one. It's called The Name of the Wind by Patrick Rothfuss. So it's a more recent sort of pen. I think it was penned in sort of the mid-2000s. And it's an interesting book in that I encountered it at a time in my life where I resonated with the protagonist. And so the protagonist, his name's Quoth. He highly, highly intelligent.
Instant name.
I know, right? Highly, highly intelligent, has the shock of red hair. And what I resonated with was that he had embarked on this journey and had chosen to pursue a certain line of his life, or a potential pathway within his sample set. It was lonely and difficult, and he was going on this journey and sort of encountering numerous things and didn't necessarily always have guides in it. And it was actually, I started reading it at the time when I had just started teaching at Hilton College in KZN. And I felt like I wasn't alone. And I know that sounds a bit odd, but he was very real to me. And so when things felt a bit overwhelming or I felt alone, I would go read and read about like what was his next adventure and what were the things that he did wrong and, you know, how he got disciplined and whatever it was. It became quite a personal book, but I think it was also incredibly beautifully written. And it was so easy to be drawn into the story. And because it's a fantasy novel, it was a completely different world. So it very much was an escape. But I just love the way that Patrick Rothfuss writes. It was one of those like page turners, literally couldn't put it down. And so many intricate aspects to it, I think, about just human experience, regardless of the world that you're in.
And that's also, it's part of it, it's a trilogy.
So it's a trilogy, but only two have been published.
Okay.
Looking forward to the third one. He apparently has rewritten it 3 or 4 times because he's very nervous to put it out. Mm-hmm. But looking forward to the end of Quest Adventures.
Do you think is it more of a, you know, the value for you is in the language and the character and the story and less on how it's all going to resolve at the end? Or are you...
I think, yeah. I think, obviously the words are detailing a world, right? So I don't know if you can necessarily separate them, but I think what I love about it is it's comforting almost. It's like, yeah. You know, when you're a child and you have that like favorite teddy bear or whatever, and it's like, it's not that the teddy bear looks nice or anything. It's just, it's what it represents.
Yeah.
And so I think Quoth for me represents a place of comfort because I feel similar to him in that there's so many things that are unknown and yet you can still be in an adventure and committed to that adventure with the unknowns. I also think that's a very actuarial kind of way of thinking. So there's innumerable unknowns and there's so much uncertainty and yet there's that element of it's still an adventure, it's still exciting and you can, if you engage well, you can use your intellect to help solve those problems. Sometimes you create more problems, which is unfortunate. And then you solve those problems, but you know, like, it's all part of it. And so I think because the words are so beautiful, it almost doesn't really matter what he writes. I would read it. So I would read all 3-4 versions of his long book.
Shopping list.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, you send them all to me. I'll read all of them.
Yeah.
Because I enjoy the world and I also enjoy, a lot of the book is actually written sort of through like these thoughts that come into it as well, and a lot of the thoughts are actually deeply, deeply meaningful and insightful and have actually made me reflect on certain aspects of my life, even though I'm not fighting a dragon or, you know, there's no magic,
not literally.
But it's like my comfort food in books.
Do you have a favorite quote?
I do. There were so many as well, but this is the one I particularly enjoyed. It's like everyone tells the story about themselves inside their own head, always, all the time. That story makes you what you are. We build ourselves out of that story. And I think what I liked about that, especially at the time when I read the first book of the trilogy, is that I was retelling my own story in that I stepped away from actuarial science and stepped into the teaching role, which is something I had longed to be for such a long time. And I had a lot of people telling me that shouldn't be my story. And reading that was like, it is my story and I own my story and I will tell you what my story is. But more than that, also defining that within my head, because it's one thing, you know, when people are questioning your decisions, saying, why are you becoming a teacher? And you're saying something and then you go home at night and you're like, do I actually believe that? Like, is that true? And then saying that is actually true. That is actually who I am. And that is the story that resonates both internally and externally. And I think that actually for me was deeply empowering, because then when I made decisions, when people would ask, for example, why did you leave actuarial science to become a teacher? It's like, because I wanted to. And I don't need to substantiate that decision to you because I can make my own decisions.
And the one who's going to suffer or enjoy the consequences.
100%. Like, does me becoming a teacher affect your life at all? Unless I'm teaching someone in your family. Probably not. So it's I found that quite, I don't know, I feel like I was almost a little bit quaky at the time because I knew that it's what I wanted, but because I was getting so much varied feedback, it was difficult to be convinced. And when I read this and I sort of resonated with a lot of the convictions that Quoth had, I became more convicted in myself. And so I think I recognized in him a number of the traits that I had in myself. And I think sometimes in literature, you see these representations and they're not you, but you can see aspects of yourself. And it's really helpful to have someone else write them down and say, oh, okay, that's actually what it is. Like, I'm in a transitionary period. I'm feeling a little bit like, you know, I'm on shaky ground here, but things will solidify and that's okay. And so I think that's what I really enjoyed about the book.
I love this idea of, because I think a theme in all or most of the books to bring along is this hero's journey. And
yes, yeah, love a hero.
Yeah, and how, you know, you can almost see yourself and writing yourself the never-ending story where, you know, the confusion between his story and, you know, the book and all that, and how someone like a literary character can be one of your guides.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you can kind of place yourself somewhere in the hero's journey based on what your favorite characters are doing. I love that.
Yeah. And that's why I think there's value also in rereading books, because I think the book doesn't change, but you do, right? Mm. And so I think when you reread a book, you sometimes get different aspects from it because you're different.
Yes.
You know, like there might be certain undertones that you didn't have the emotional capacity or life experiences to cotton onto when you first encountered it. And then later on, you're like, wow, that's profound. Where it was maybe a part of a book that you would have rather skipped over the first time you read it.
And that's also such a kind of intrinsic part of the hero's journey, is you come back and you may be at the same place, but you're different.
Yeah.
People see you differently. And yeah, love that imagery.
Yeah.
But this story of identity, I find quite interesting, and how it can be quite fluid, and how that can unsettle a person, especially if, you know, you've had these self-beliefs such a long time. And we're speaking about, you know, advice to actuarial students not to make the actuarial student their whole identity. And how would you advise, or how should a student know when this degree they've chosen is not for them, and to make that call? Because that's also courageous.
It is. And I think it's not an easy one. I think I actually was chatting to a student the other day, and they'd had a bit of a rocky journey towards sort of getting their degree. And they were saying to me, you know, what are my options? What can I do? And one of the first questions I asked them is, I said, is this something you really want? And I think the reason I asked that question is, I think people don't necessarily ask that question. They don't. And the thing is, what you want changes over time. And if you don't re-examine it, then sometimes you're playing off like the old version of yourself and the old version of the things you want. And then you're wondering why you're not fulfilled, or why you're not feeling the way you used to. And I think a big part of identity is also reflection and saying, okay, who am I now? Not as opposed to the question, who am I? Because I think who am I is fluid, like as you were saying. And I think for students that are in the position where possibly they either want to leave the degree or have to leave the degree, there's that element of reflection where they need to say, you know, should I let go now? And if I don't want to let go, why am I holding on? And is that holding on going to be sustainable? And then also I think I'm a big believer in holding things with open hands, because things change and can be dynamic. And I think that's also an intrinsically actuarial way of viewing the world, is that the world is dynamic. That's why we have to update models, and, you know, and that's why our models are almost always wrong. And, you know, and I think students need to be sort of very set in their aims, but flexible in their approach to them. I guess that's, I mean, it's quite a rambling way of answering your question, but those would be the general sort of principles I would adhere to when engaging in that conversation.
And it sounds like, you know, needing to perhaps let go of a little bit of ego to answer that question honestly. Is this what you want?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I read a book by Ryan Holiday called, I think it's called Ego is the Enemy.
Okay.
It's more a self-helpy book, so I don't know if it would be completely down your street.
The obstacles.
Yes, yeah. No. And so I think what's interesting about his viewpoint is he subscribes to Stoicism. And so obviously there's various virtues that underpin that. But he talks about how he uses various examples from history where ego has basically precluded people from being effective in various instances or situations. And I think humility is one of the most underplayed characteristics that you can have in a person, because humility means that you are teachable. And if you are teachable, then you can change and you can progress and you can be dynamic to situations. But if you have an ego and if you always go into a situation thinking you know better, I think you forego so many learning opportunities. And I think if more students were like that, I think that their journeys would be so much easier, because often the journey is so difficult because you're letting go of this sort of shining version of yourself instead of saying, I'm actually a work in progress.
Well, if nothing else, that actuarial degree teaches you humility.
Yeah, big grief. A good group. Yeah.
What's the last book we're going to discuss?
My last book is actually more a self-helpy kind of book.
Okay.
So it is by Jordan Peterson. I know, a fairly controversial figure. But his book called 12 Rules for Life. And it's basically, he's a clinical psychologist. And he writes a book from his experience as a clinical psychologist. And he talks through various metrics that he's seen have been effective in people's lives. And his whole underpin is that in order for life to be bearable, you have to find meaning. And that meaning is obviously different for different people. But life is intrinsically characterized by suffering. And if you find meaning, it's the only thing that makes that suffering worthwhile. And so,
gosh, deep.
Yeah, I know. And I mean, obviously not everyone agrees with everything that he said, but I'm a big believer in that just because you don't agree with one or two or whatever number of things someone says doesn't mean they don't have anything of value to say. And I think the particular chapter that I resonated with in the book was chapter 2. And it was entitled, Treat Yourself Like Someone You Are Responsible for Helping. And I think what was interesting about that for me was that I think I tend to think that help is always for other people. And then actually saying, well, if someone came to me with my story and asked for help, what would I do? And that for me was a massive shift in perspective, because if I did that exercise, I realized that I wasn't doing the things that were helping myself. And in many instances, I was impeding my own progress, because one, I wasn't doing what I should do, or two, I wasn't asking for help when I needed it, because of possibly ego, because of, you know, sometimes I didn't want to actually even face the reality of the issues that I was having to kind of deal with. And I read this also at a very pivotal point in my life when I was at that crossroads between teaching and going back into corporate. And I remember reading the chapter and then saying to myself, okay, Margs, like, if someone came to you and said this is the crossroads they're at and they told you that they'd wanted to be a teacher since they were like 3, what would you tell them? And I remember being like, well, then just go teach. Like, what are you waiting for? Like, just go do it. And then I remember thinking to myself, I wish I had asked myself this question earlier. And then what I realized is that when I did go teach, I found immense meaning in that. So even though I was lonely often in that space and I was not being remunerated as much and I was away from my family, and those could be characterized as suffering, because I found my job so meaningful, I was probably 10 to 15 times happier than I was when I was in my corporate job.
Do you have any other quotes you love from this book?
Another one from there is, and I'm paraphrasing it now, but it's, stand up with your shoulders back. And now I'm like cursing my pastor. Yeah. but the sort of the theme of that chapter was saying there's an element of self-respect that you need to have. And people can cotton onto that, right? And so if I come here and I am slumped like this or whatever, I give you a view of how I think of myself. And you subconsciously will treat me according to that view. And so the way I present myself, and the way that I speak and the way that I portray myself is very important, because that is how I'm perceived, and it will determine the impact I can make. And so I mean, there's numerous gems throughout the book. Yeah. And I think because he's a clinical psychologist, the cases that he speaks to are also very interesting. But his call is fundamentally take responsibility for your life, find meaning, and then life is worthwhile. And I think that that is rung true in my own life.
Okay, so let's run through the books we've spoken about. Middlemarch by George Eliot, The Fellowship of the Ring by J.R.R. Tolkien, Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery, Name of the Wind by Patrick Rothfuss, and 12 Rules for Life by Jordan B. Peterson.
That's it.
So if I had to be very cruel and send you to a desert island with just one of these books.
Oh, goodness.
Which one would it be?
It would probably be Lord of the Rings.
Why?
Because let's be honest, if I was in a desert island, my one aim would be to get off of there. So having a book that talks about the beginning of a journey, I think would be quite helpful. But I think also similar to the comments I made around Name of the Wind, I think the characters in The Fellowship of the Ring I very much consider my friends. So I think I wouldn't feel so alone.
Amazing. So we didn't get around to speaking about your master's, but just to end things off, tell us, what is your master's? Do you have a master's topic yet, dissertation topic?
So I'm doing it part-time. So currently this year I'm doing my coursework, and then I'm going to do my thesis next year. So what I'm particularly interested is in looking at the concept of mathematical literacy. So both within the subject offered at schools, but as a concept by itself. So sort of say, if someone is not highly mathematical or struggles to learn maths in its sort of more core or abstract or theoretical form, what maths should they know in order to function well within societies? So that's kind of my point of interest, but it probably ask me in a year's time and it will be something completely different.
In the meantime, where can people get hold of you? What's your YouTube channel? You know, we enter your podcast.
Okay, so please don't go watch my mathless YouTube channel. I'm not going to give you that. Unless you are a trick student and doing math lit, which seems very neat. But you can find me. I'm on Instagram. I am on LinkedIn. Under Margie Conradi. But if you would like to listen to my podcast, it's on Instagram, but also on all major streaming platforms. So What's It Actually About? Which seemed like a funny, it seemed funny at the time, but has worn off over time. But, you know, it's too late to rename.
No, I think it'll always be good.
I heard someone message me in the early days saying, you made a spelling mistake. It should be actually. And I'm like, you missed the pun.
You see, you're clearly an idea.
I was like, it will come. I was like, I said to them, say it out loud and then it will come.
Margie, to thank you for being on the podcast. I have a gift for you.
Oh, thank you.
I wish I'd known that you listen to audiobooks, because this was so difficult to get hold of.
No, I will read it. Has it got this book smell?
So I could only get a second hand copy.
Then it definitely has the book smell.
Half of dust just out of it.
Perfect. Well loved. Well loved.
I'm so sad that it's apparently not available anymore, but it's called Fugitive Pieces by Anne Michaels. And
lovely.
She's actually a poet, and you can tell.
By the way she writes.
It is the most beautifully written
story.
And the story itself is beautiful as well.
Thank you. That's so kind of you. That's lovely.
Yeah. So, I'd love to know what you think about it.
I will send you my review.
Great. Any last thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners?
It's interesting. As we've talked, I think like all good conversations, you actually kind of see things differently at the end of them. And I think I really have appreciated the reflective process, because I think when you're in the process of being shaped, you don't always realize how impactful something has been on your life. And I think in talking through it, I actually realize how reading has been a cornerstone of my life and has been a comfort through various circumstances. So thank you for that.
Oh, that's the beauty of books.
Yeah, the beauty of books.
Thanks so much, Margie.
Thank you.